Accession number 18191, Reel 2.
I was going to ask you, you mentioned you went down the Gulf to Bahrain and places like that. They must have been very rudimentary in those days, a few tents and a man with a flag, was it, or what?
Yes, it was extraordinarily rudimentary. I think Bahrain, as far as I remember, had a runway, but Sharjah certainly didn't. Sharjah was just a flat patch of sand, and the landing directions were marked out with oil strips on the sand, so they could give you a direction in which to land, and you found the oil strip pointing that way. Yes, it was pretty rudimentary. I didn't, whether I say Sharjah, Shaiba, yes, I didn't ever go into Shaiba. I used Sharjah and Bahrain, but not Shaiba.
Did you go to Kuwait at all?
No. Yeah. No, Kuwait...
probably didn't even...
I don't think it was operating then.
Yeah.
And nor Dubai. I've been to Dubai since, but that, I'm pretty sure that didn't have an airstrip then.
So you did a two-year tour on this...
Well, what happened, yes, whilst I was, after I got back from my tour in, 1 month tour, this was up in Palestine with the army, I worked myself up to a VIP category, you see. And once you get a VIP category on these squadrons, you will probably be sent somewhere to a VIP job. And I don't think I had my VIP category for more than about a month before they found me one, and I was posted to Karachi, which was then Pakistan. The partition of India and Pakistan had happened,
47, wasn't it?
Yes, it was 47, and I got there in 48, April 48, I think it was. So about 6 or 7 months after partition. And I was posted to, the RAF had what was called a comm flight at Karachi, and its main purpose in life was to fly around the CNC of the Army, the CNC of the Air Force, and government, Pakistani government members. I didn't stay at Karachi very long because the whole thing, for some reason, was moved up to Peshawar in the northwest frontier. We only had two aeroplanes and two crews, and they were Dakotas, and they were pretty swept-up Dakotas with all VIP fit inside and so on. Very nice aeroplanes by the standards we'd had on the squadrons, this is. And so I spent... time flying General Gracie, who was CNC of the Army.
This was
the Pakistan Army. He was their first CNC after partition. Air Marshal Perry Keane, who was the RAF, or the Pakistan Air Force Commander, and he was once again the first Pakistan Air Force Commander straight after partition. And various... political people, Sir Hugh Dundas, no, the wrong name.
Sir in those days, he was...
Oh, no, the one I'm thinking of was Sir Hugh somebody, but it wasn't Dundas. Mm. I've lost it for a minute. Mm. But we were quite busy doing this sort of thing, and a lot of our flying was in the northwest frontier, and it's very interesting flying amongst the mountains and so on up there. And for the first time in my life, I was actually fired at from the ground, which had never happened to me before. And it was people will remember there was a chap called the Fakir of Ippi, and he held a whole sort of the mountainous region up in northwest Pakistan, and didn't care much for anybody. And if aeroplanes came across, he had something sort of like Bofors guns type things.
Oh, serious guns.
Oh, yes, they were serious guns. Mm-hmm. And we were just flying along, going to a place called Miram Shah. when one of the passengers came up and said, "Crikey, get out of here, we've got gun explosion puffs coming up beside us." Well, crikey, I don't know where we go or where it's coming from. Anyhow, we in fact continued to Miram Shah. It's the only time it ever happened. But this chap wasn't very far away from Miram Shah. He would lob a few shells in on Miram Shah at night from time to time, but never when you could see him. He wouldn't do it during the day, but he was doing this firing at us during the day.
You were enjoying the flying, really. I mean, after all your expectations of typhoons in the early days.
Yes, it was very interesting, amazingly so. Yeah. Anyhow,
were you married at this time? Or?
Oh no, not at all.
Still a free agent.
Yeah. Mm. Towards the end of 1948. Air Marshal Perry Keane was posted home, and his replacement was Air Marshal RLR, actually, that's Richard, actually, who was always known as Batchy. And when he arrived on the scene, he sculled around amongst everything very quickly and said to me, "You are going to be my personal pilot, and your crew will be my personal crew, and I'm going to have an even more swept-up DC-3 than these two you've got." And so very quickly, another DC-3 was specially prepared with a VIP fit. It could carry only 8 passengers, but it had long-range tanks in it. It could stay in the air for about 15 hours, which was over twice the normal length of DC-3 time. He had a bedroom in it so that he could sleep in it if he wanted to, and a much more swept-up galley set up than we'd ever had in anything else. And from that time on, all the rest of my stay in Pakistan, which was for about another year, I was flying as captain of the personal crew to Air Marshal Atchley, who did a lot of flying. He wouldn't leave the poor old Pakistani Air Force alone for 1 minute. He was always watching them, and we were always going out of Karachi. By this time, we were based back in Karachi because his headquarters was at Karachi. Back in Karachi. But we were frequently up to Peshawar or to Quetta and wherever the Pakistani Air Force had stations, he was watching them, Miram Shah and their college, which I can't remember the name of that field for the moment, but it was somewhere between Peshawar and Rawalpindi. Can't remember the name of it. And we would also have to make trips over to East Pakistan, because what is now known as Bangladesh at that time was East Pakistan, and of course the Pakistan Air Force had various facilities and things over there, so we'd go over there and see all that. And we could do a straight haul across India from Karachi to Dhaka or Chittagong, whichever he wanted to be at, without stopping. If we'd had an ordinary DC-3, we would have had to have stopped at Delhi or somewhere en route. Not that that would have mattered a lot, because the boss of the Indian Air Force was also an RAF officer. I can't remember his name for a minute, but he was a friend of Atchley's, and so there would have been no hassle about us stopping there if we'd wanted to.
But you had a co-pilot for these trips, was it?
Oh, yes, we had. Initially, it was an all-RAF crew that I had, but gradually, as time went on, we changed over until... Yes, before I left, I was the only RAF officer on the crew. The rest of them were all Pakistanis, and very good, too. Very good.
So how long did that job last?
Well, at the end of... My tour should have ended at the end of 1949, and as the end of 1949, or at least probably from about the middle of 1949, I began to start thinking about what I was going to do next. But of course, I've missed one little bit in all this. Whilst I was at Cabrit, um, I applied for a permanent commission in the Air Force, and I had to have an interview with the Air Officer Commanding, and I can't remember his name, I regret now, Air Officer Commanding Middle East for this, but the end result was that, yes, I was put up for a permanent commission. And I don't know what time elapsed, 4 or 6 weeks, my permanent commission came through. 10 days after it came through, I also was given a short service commission in the Air Force, which was really quite interesting. Anyhow, that was sharply sorted out, and I held on to the permanent commission. So by this time, I had a permanent commission in the Air Force. And so by the middle of 1949, when I was heading towards, well, within 6 months of coming home at the end of my overseas tour, I thought, crikey, well, I've really got to think about what I'm going to do now because I'm a career officer in the Air Force. But I was still not terribly keen on getting a desk job, in fact, very far from it. But I realized that having never had one, the chances were I would probably end up with one, and I was resigned to it. But at about that time, this is the middle of 1949, Air Marshal actually had arranged for the Pakistan Air Force to buy Hawker Furies, which were about the latest and hottest of the piston engine fighters at the time. And there was a version which wasn't a Sea Fury. Originally, I think they started life as Sea Furies, but this there was just an ordinary land version of it. And he arranged that the Pakistan Air Force would be equipped with 2 or 3 squadrons of Furies. And the first Fury that came out to Karachi was flown out by Neville Duke in, as I say, middle of 1949. And Neville Duke was going to stay for a couple of nights before going home, and during this time I got to know him a little bit. And a few weeks later out came another one, again with Neville Duke, and the end result was that I got to, over 2 or 3 deliveries, I got to know Neville Duke fairly well, and I was talking to him about what I might do when I got back home, because I was, you know, really concerned with what was going to happen to my career. And he said, why don't you have a go for test pilot school? And I said, well, I've seen this requirement in or this thing in AMOs about test pilot school and what the qualifications are. And I said, I qualify in every respect except that I've only got 8 types in my logbook, and I need to have a minimum of 10 types in my logbook before I can even apply for the wretched thing. Well, he said, you know, you ought to be able to do something about getting some more types in your logbook, but it wasn't terribly easy. I mean, Dakotas were really the only thing around the place. But it sparked off my imagination even a bit more, because I had sort of thought about it, but it had passed away again. Anyhow, Air Marshal actually had an aeroplane which he kept there. It belonged to the Pakistan Air Force, but he kept it there for his own private use for fun flying, and this was a Tempest. I don't know how it came to be there, but it was there. And so I thought, well, crikey, there's this Tempest, and he doesn't fly it all day long, you see. And I'm going to ask him one day. So very quickly I asked him if I could fly it. Of course you can fly it, he said. You can do anything you like with it except break it. And so I got myself into this thing, and I read its pilot's notes, and remembering my Harvard days, set off in this thing. And it was a hot ship by Harvard standards, I must say. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. And so this got me up to...
You didn't get any frights in it at all?
No, I didn't. I was very lucky, I think, indeed. And so I got myself several trips in this thing, but it made me number 9 in my logbook. And then, somewhere along the line, a dove appeared on the scene. And I thought, crikey, here we go, you see. And so I engineered myself into this dove and flew it. And lo and behold, I had 10 types. And so I thought, okay, I now qualify. I've got all the requirements. You had to have a permanent commission. You had to have so many hours in your logbook. I had that. One or two other things. And 10 types. And I now got the lot. So, of course, by this time, I knew Air Marshal actually terribly well. And I said to him, look, you know, I'm going to go home early December. And I've been thinking that I'd like to go to test pilot school. Yes, he said, that's just what you should do. So he said, I'll write a note recommending that you should go to test pilot school. So off I come home. And as soon as, within days of getting home, I had to report to the Air Ministry in London. And I was interviewed by a squadron leader who looked at my records and said, ha, looks as though you're set for a desk job, doesn't it? And I said, well, I don't think so. What do you mean? I said, well, I've been recommended for test pilot school. Who's recommending you for test pilot school? He said, Air Marshal actually. I said, oh, if Air Marshal actually is recommending you for test pilot school, I expect you're going to test pilot school. And that was more or less the end of that interview. But it wasn't quite that easy. Having got home, there was a new thing floating around called instrument ratings, which had appeared on the scene since I'd left for overseas. And so before I could do anything else, I had to have an instrument rating. And although the Air Force had plenty of DC-3 units, Dakota units in UK, with instructors and the rest, and I could have quickly done an instrument rating course on one of these things, being qualified on DC-3s, no, they don't do that. They send me off to Finningley and teach me to fly a Wellington. Well, I didn't really mind because this was yet another type in the logbook, but that's the way the Air Force worked. They taught me to fly a Wellington, and I had to go through a Wellington course and then do my instrument rating on a Wellington.
They were being phased out at that time, weren't they, Wellington?
Well, they were, yeah, but they were around for quite a while, even afterwards, yes. Yeah. So I got my instrument rating, and the next thing was an interview for test pilot school. And that was held at Farnborough, at the test pilot school, a board of about 6 people, I think. It was a very formidable array of people, but it was headed up by Group Captain Snaith, who was the commandant at the test pilot school. And the moment he heard that I had just come back from Pakistan and been flying Air Marshal actually about, he said, oh, crikey, you've got to be here. He said, I know, actually, very well. We were on the high-speed flight together in the days down at Hamble and so on a Calshot. And, yes, you'll have to come, he said. Well, what with a bit of other things, there was a little bit of academic side. They made us do some writing to see if we could write sensibly and so on and this, that, and the other. The end result was I ended up at test pilot school starting the course in 1950.
What number course was that?
I think it was 9. Yes.
Do you remember who was on that course with you?
Yes. I can remember most of them. I remember extraordinarily well one of the tutors on the course who in fact also sat on my interview board, and he was then Squadron Leader Saxelby. He's now retired, but he retired as Group Captain Saxelby, and I know him terribly well. And although he doesn't live all that near to me, he comes here and visits quite frequently. He's one of my oldest surviving RAF chums. I remember a lot of other people on the course. Unfortunately, we lost a few of them over the years. Some before the course ended, even. And test flying was still losing a lot of people in the early 50s, but this gradually solved itself, and you don't hear too much about test pilots biting the dust anymore. The whole thing is done much more scientifically and carefully than ever it was. Well, I mean, it was starting then. We were getting very much more careful about flight test work, but it wasn't really sort of...
Well, it was such a quantum leap in aircraft, wasn't it?
Well, there was that too, but you know, you've seen it on films of things before the war where a designer gets his aeroplane built and then he finds the guy that's going to fly it, and what he says to him, okay, get it in the air and find out how fast it'll go and how high it'll go, and really, you know, they gave you the impression that was all that was needed to be known about the aeroplane, but... It wasn't quite that bad, but it was, you know, it was a bit like that. And people used to go rushing into things without really working up to them too carefully and so on. But when aeroplanes started to cost £1 million each, people thought an awful lot more about this type of thing. I mean, £1 million is nothing now, but then, crikey, it was a lot of money for one aeroplane. And so you thought a lot more carefully about it, and you know, you were briefed, you talked to the designers very carefully about what they thought might happen, and so on and so on. And all this was drilled into us at test pilot school. Very much so, it's part of the thing as the care required in doing
it. You got your first jet experience there, presumably?
Yes, that's where I got my first jet experience. My first jet aeroplane was Vampire, followed very quickly by a Meteor. No jet duel at all, straight in. And my first four-engine experience was at test pilot school on a Lincoln. There they did send a Lincoln qualified guy to ride with you on your first ride in the thing. And also, mosquitoes. They had a mosquito or two on the course, and they didn't let you loose in those without an instructor on board first shot. But... well, I mean, Sea Furies, the jet aeroplanes, they didn't have two-seater ones, so you just had to go. But let's face it, this was part of test pilot training. Test pilots were going to have in their career somewhere down the line, almost certainly, to start from nil with an aeroplane. Then no one else will have flown it before. So you've got to sort of get used to the idea. And it's no problem. Aeroplanes are aeroplanes.
So you finished the course with the idea of becoming an RAF test pilot.
Oh, yes. Well, I didn't even finish that course. I was always forever being posted to something else in my whole career, it seemed. Halfway through the course, another chap, Flight Lieutenant Turner, and myself were picked off the course and selected to go out to the U.S. Navy test pilot school at Patuxent River in Maryland. The test pilot school at Farnborough and the Navy Test Pilot School at Patuxent River liaised very closely together, always. And we always had two U.S. Navy pilots on the course at Farnborough, and in return we sent two back to Patuxent River. So I was halfway through our course. I did 6 months, which was out of the 12-month course, sent out to Pax River. And their course was only 6 months long. It was more intensive than ours. It really was. But and I did the whole of their 6 months course, and I actually graduated there.
And you flew American naval types?
Oh, yes, because by this now, you see, suddenly I was getting types in my logbook like mad, having picked up about 12 new types on the test pilot's school at Farnborough, and something like 8 or 10 more at Patuxent River. And so I was getting a string of types in my logbook, all quite interesting. I picked up flying boats for the first time in the Catalina. Two more jet aeroplanes, a thing called a Banshee and a Cougar, and a thing called a Sky Raider, which was a big piston engine. Torpedo bomber, I think we would have called it. It was a big single engine aeroplane, and it was a very good aeroplane. In fact, our Navy actually had some of them for a while. But I flew that, and had
one. Cutlass around at the time.
No, we didn't have Cutlass there. At least, if it was around, it hadn't got down to test pilot school level. I think that was probably it. I think it was around. I had an unfortunate session with the Sky Raider. It so happened that the Sky Raider was one of the few piston engine aeroplanes, propeller aeroplanes that I know of that had air brakes on it. And its air brakes consisted of three flaps which stuck out of the fuselage aft of the wing and ahead of the tail. And there were two flaps which stuck out sideways and one underneath. And part of your landing drill was always to make jolly sure that your air brakes were closed before you landed, because being an ordinary tailwheel aeroplane, if you landed with the air brakes open, you didn't use the tailwheel, you used the bottom air brake flap to land. And regrettably, my colleague out there, Topsy Turner, did just that and ground this air brake off it. Well, okay, they put a new one on and we were back in flying pretty quickly. But not long after that, I was flying it out over Chesapeake Bay. We only had this one
Sky Raider
on the school. And I was flying it out over Chesapeake Bay, which there was an area out over Chesapeake Bay. And Chesapeake Bay is big. You can't see the far side of it from one side. It's that big. It's really like being out in the ocean. And we had a special area designated for us to go and do flight tests, because we spent so much time heading cockpit on flight test work. And I was sent out to climb up to 30,000 feet. This thing could get up to 30,000 feet and do whatever I was going to do. I can't really remember. But halfway up at about 17,000 feet, or just over halfway up, you have to change gear on its supercharger. And changing gear on superchargers is always a little bit of a hairy business with a piston engine aeroplane. Some people think, oh, you can just thump it through, but I never did that. I always used to throttle the engine back, change gear, and let it do it gently, and then put the power on again, which I did. But when I put the power on again, nothing came. There was no power at all. All that happened was a load of white smoke came out of the exhaust stubs all around. Aha, very interesting. Anyhow, I'd been at Pax, I'd left Pax River and was climbing out, and I thought, crikey, I must head back and get as far back as I can. I called them base and told them I got this and this problem, and so I thought, I've got two options here. I can bail out of the wretched thing, Or fly it back and ditch it, or perhaps if I'm lucky, I may be able to get it back far enough if I can get high enough overhead to land it back on. But I wasn't ever sure I'd do that. And I decided against bailing out, because I would be much further away from the shore than I would be otherwise. And so I thought, I'll make it back as far as I can. And so I decided to ditch, and once you decide to ditch, the first thing you do is look for a boat or something, hopefully, that you can go alongside, because then you'll be picked up quickly. Well, this was comparatively inshore waters, and do you think I could see a boat? I couldn't see one anywhere. So, anyhow, I eventually had to ditch the thing. And I got out of it and paddled away backwards on, sort of with my parachute still on and the dinghy underneath me and the rest. And I just got to the port wingtip when the thing just upped and went straight down, nose down into the water, and that was disappeared. And I found that the parachute underneath me was supporting me terribly well. It was almost like sitting in an armchair on the water. But I also had a dinghy under there, and I thought, well, you know, I'm sort of set about getting this dinghy out and so on. I'd been in touch with the control tower all the time. They knew what was happening, where I was, and a rescue launch was already on the way out, but I couldn't see it anywhere. Anyhow, I thought, okay, get my parachute off, so I unbuckle all the parachute stuff, and it comes up floating beside me, and I start to strip off the dinghy bit of it, dinghy pack, which is on top of the parachute, which you're actually sitting on, when suddenly I'm aware of a disturbance and a boat appears. And it was a local fishing boat, the one I'd been looking for, but I couldn't find. Anyhow, the end result was he picked me up and the various bits. And I suppose, well, maybe another 10 minutes elapsed and the rescue launch caught up with it and they took me in.